What can I say? Last lecture of the course. There's still a couple standard model particles that we haven't talked about. One of them is the top quark, and I think that got left out, and I will post some bonus lecture notes about the top quark. The other one is the Higgs boson. Now, so far in this course, I've told you about the predictions of the standard model, and I showed you that those predictions are beautifully obeyed experimentally. And we've gone through basically the entire standard model, and if I could actually, well, you'll see the stuff on the top quark. The top quark works too. Its properties, there's some properties of it that are quite unusual, which are actually obeyed in the experiments on the top quark. And then we come to the last particle of the standard model, which is the Higgs boson. And so what you would, of course, really like me to do is to give a talk on the Higgs boson and its properties in experiment and why these are in beautiful agreement with the standard model. But there are two reasons why I can't do that. The first reason is that the Higgs boson hasn't yet been discovered. So this is something for the future. The second is that the story that the standard model gives you about the Higgs boson is, in my opinion, probably not correct. And that's a subject that we'll discuss toward the end of this talk. But the first thing I wanted to do was to give you, if you like, the rest of the story on the standard model. That is, I'd like to tell you what the standard model predicts about the Higgs boson, how we would go looking for it, and what kind of experiments might be sensitive to it. So first of all, what is the Higgs boson? Well, you remember that when I wrote down the SU2 cross U1 model, I introduced the Higgs field, which is a complex doublet with hypercharge 1/2, which played an absolutely essential role in the theory, because this thing has a potential, which is has its minimum at a non-symmetric point. It gets a vacuum expectation value. And that vacuum expectation value gives mass to all particles in the standard model. Then what we were able to do was to go to a special gauge where only the physical degrees of freedom are apparent in this field. And in that gauge, the form is V plus H of x. And V is a number. And H of x is a scalar field. And so the excitations of that scalar field are what we call the Higgs boson. And this is an additional scalar particle beyond the quarks, leptons, and gauge bosons, which is an important part of the standard model. And as I said already, this is the one piece of the standard model that hasn't yet been observed. And so it seems kind of interesting to think about what its properties are and how you can find it. Let me discuss that. So first of all, let me write down this potential energy again, mu squared phi squared plus lambda phi to the fourth. The minimum of this potential occurs at the place of mu over lambda to the 1/2. If I expand about that minimum, we find that with this form of the scalar field, we find that this is mu squared v squared over 2 plus mu squared h squared plus some nonlinear terms. So the potential at its bottom has positive curvature. There's then a positive mass term. The mass of the Higgs boson, then, is the mass term of the scalar field. M squared is equal to 2 mu squared is the equation. OK, now, this equation doesn't really do much for you. Because so far, all of our predictions in the standard model were based on the coupling constants, g sub s, g, g prime, and v, the vacuum expectation value. We didn't have another quantity that depended on mu and lambda separately. This is the one. So actually, we might as well take m Higgs to be our extra parameter. M Higgs is not determined in the standard model. It's just another free parameter, and all the predictions that we make will be for a Higgs of a certain mass. So from now on, everything will depend on this new parameter. Now you might ask, what limits are there on this parameter? Well, if I take these equations, I can rewrite them in the following way, that lambda is equal to 1 half m Higgs squared over v squared, which is equal to, well, that's what it is. V is 246 GeV, you remember. M Higgs is whatever it is, so that means that lambda over 4 pi, which is some kind of measure of the strength of the Higgs nonlinear interaction, is given by m Higgs squared over 8 pi v squared. And this number is of order 1 when m Higgs is equal to 1.2 TeV, or 1,000 GeV. So roughly between 0 and 1,000 GeV, that's where the Higgs is. We know it's not near 0 because people have looked for it experimentally. There are some technical reasons in the standard model why the Higgs can't be less than 7 GeV. But that's kind of irrelevant because that region has also been explored experimentally in a way that I'll describe in a moment. OK, there's one more constraint on the Higgs mass, which is that if the Higgs is heavy, it actually has an effect on these precision electroweak observables that we discussed on Wednesday. So in particular, diagrams like this for Z and W actually affect the Z and W masses and ruin some of the good relations that I wrote about on Monday. The size of the effect is alpha weak over 4 pi times mz squared times the log of m Higgs squared over mz squared. So roughly, when the logarithm becomes large, you can get effects that affect the last couple decimal places in those precision measurements that I told you about. And this actually gives a quite strong limit. It tells you that within the standard model, m Higgs is less than about 180 GeV. Maybe I should say that this is an indirect way of bounding the Higgs. So you could add something else that would couple to the Z boson that would counteract this effect. N is some kind of new particle. But within the standard model itself, with no other new particles, this is a constraint. Of course, we don't know what's out there, so maybe we should also think of heavier Higgses and some other counterbalancing effects. Yes?
Is this going to be dependent on the vacuum integration?
I'm sorry? This constraint?
Yeah.
Oh, no, this constraint is for the all the parameters being what they really are. Okay, so it depends on mz being what it really is.
All right.
Okay. So now there's still some territory to search in. The Higgs could be light. It could be up to this mass, maybe. In some kind of more general model, it could be all the way up to this mass. How do we look? So to figure that out, we should write down the couplings of the Higgs boson. So now we have to write down the terms in the standard model, which involve the field H. And actually, I've kind of written them all down, so let me just remind you. The standard model contains dependence on the Higgs field in the Z and W mass terms. So G squared comes in as V plus H, W plus W minus, no 1/2 there. There's a 1/2 G squared plus G prime squared times, again, V plus H times ZZ. And for all the fermion masses, there's the lambda fermion divided by the square root of 2, V plus H. And you remember yesterday I showed you that in the standard model, these terms are all diagonal, they're flavor conserving, it's just a psi-psi bar with your scalar. Okay, and then there's some nonlinear terms. But the terms nonlinear in H would all involve multiple Higgses. So in other words, I have to make a Higgs to produce a Higgs. If you don't even have one, maybe we should just think of Higgs. So these terms are all incredibly simple. And please notice that as soon as they're all completely specified. I actually know all these coefficients, because they're just the masses of the various particles. And so the standard model gives us a complete, totally predictive theory of the Higgs interactions. And now I just might as well write down the Feynman diagram as Higgs W comes, which is equal to 2i. Now, this thing here is MW. I take out a factor of V and I put in a factor of Higgs. Similarly for Z. And similarly for any quark or lepton, minus I and F over V times 1 is the direct matrix. Okay, well, that's pretty simple. So these are the vertices through which the Higgs couples the standard model particles. And now we can just use these to calculate the production rate of the Higgs and its decays. Well, there's something which is good and something which is bad about these equations. The thing which you see in them is that the Higgs couples to mass, proportional to the mass term. And that's clear because it's the Higgs that actually gives the mass through its vacuum interpretation method. Unfortunately, what that means is that the Higgs couplings are absolutely minuscule to those particles that we can actually put in accelerators, namely electrons, up quarks, and down quarks. So this coupling here is of order, you remember, 10 to the minus 5 or 10 to the minus 6 for electrons, up quarks, and down quarks. So in order to find the Higgs, we have to somehow make a heavy particle. And then we have to let that heavy particle radiate. And so there are various strategies for this, which I'll talk about in just a little while. To lead up to that, what I'd like to do is to calculate the branching ratios of the Higgs. That is, what is the Higgs decay to? What final states are we looking for? Now, those also, because of these equations, depend on the heaviest particle in the theory. So if the Higgs is heavy enough to decay in the W's and Z's, that's going to dominate. Actually, it even dominates the top quark for some funny reason that we'll talk about. When the Higgs is not heavy enough to decay to W's and Z's, and I think if you take this constraint seriously, that's quite likely, then it'll decay into B, and if it's lighter, it'll decay into tau, et cetera, until you totally run out of steam. Okay, let me write down the formula. So first of all, the Higgs decay to W plus W minus. It's a pretty straightforward exercise. You take this Feynman diagram, you put polarization vectors on it, you square it. You guys have done this before. When the smoke clears, what you get is the following. Alpha W over 16, and Higgs cubed over MW squared. 1 minus 4 and W squared over Higgs squared. Well, I didn't say the answer was simple. I just said it was easy to obtain. This is phase space here. Okay. And for Z is a very similar expression. Actually, the 2-to-1 ratio here is characteristic of an isospin zero process. And actually, these decay rates are, except for the WZ mass differences, completely weak isospins. And Z over K squared plus 12. And Z over K squared. And the appropriate phase space factor. I guess ordinarily you would expect this to be of order alpha W times M Higgs. So it's a little surprising that there's an enhancement of the form M Higgs squared over M W squared. So there's the factor of alpha, and there's an extra M Higgs squared over M W squared. This has an explanation which is kind of interesting. M Higgs squared over M W squared. M Higgs is proportional to lambda G squared, and W is proportional to G squared V squared. So this whole thing turns out to be lambda, the strength of the Higgs self-coupling. Now, if you ask what polarization states dominate this, it's actually the polarization states where the W's and Z's are longitudinally polarized. So those are the states which are actually the Goldstone bosons that were eaten by the W and Z when it became massive. And so the intrinsic coupling to those states is not G, it's lambda. And it's reflected in this one. So the decay rate for Higgs to W and Z is much larger than you thought it would be. And so that causes these things to dominate the Higgs final states when the Higgs gets heavy enough to decay to these things. Actually, if I put in this number of 1200 GeV and I evaluate this formula, I find that the Higgs width is equal to the Higgs mass. So it's an enormously strongly coupled particle if the Higgs mass gets up into this TDE range. And eventually it just kind of disappears in some complicated strong relation. For Higgs in this range, maybe about 200 GeV, it's a fairly narrow thing that decays the W's. Okay, now, if the Higgs is not heavy enough to decay to W and Z, it has to decay to the next heaviest particle, which is the bottom particle. But then you see there's a big fall off in these rates. Because we fall off by a factor 1/2 mv squared over mw squared, which is 2 times 10 to the minus 3. So this allows a lot of subdominant processes to also be visible. So in particular, one important one is where the Higgs decays to a W, which then decays on this side, and an off-shell W that decays on this side, QQ bar or left on the treatment. So here the W propagator is Q squared minus MW squared. But in this diagram, we wouldn't be on shell, we'd be off shell here. And then we get on shell when we actually get our four body. So this is suppressed with respect to the rate of W plus W minus, but it can still be comparable to the rate of GK. And finally, just for completeness, I should write down the formula for Higgs for fermion and antifermion. That's alpha W over 8. And Higgs, the fermion mass comes in because it's in the vertex here. I've replaced V by MW, that's where the alpha came from. And then 1 minus 4 MF squared over M Higgs squared to the 3 halves. And then NF, so I get another factor of 3, of course, for color for the bottom. And then this would be 1 quark and 1. Now, there are other subdominant processes that are also interesting and which are very important in the question of how you look for things. One of them is this loop process. So if I start with the Higgs boson here. The Higgs boson couples to quarks, and the quarks can then annihilate into gluons. And so this loop diagram gives a way for the Higgs to decay to two gluons. The gluons are massless particles, but the quarks can be massive. This diagram has the funny property that this vertex here is proportional to the quark mass. But then the diagram dimensionally is 1 over mass, and that turns out to be the quark mass, too, and so the quark mass cancels out. Now, when the quark is lighter than the Higgs boson, you get an additional suppression of quark masses divided by the Higgs mass. When the quark is heavier than the Higgs boson, you don't. So this is actually only important when the mass of the quark, or 2mq, is heavier than the Higgs mass. And so in practice, it's in, the only quark that contributes in this group is the top quark. And then the top quark gives a contribution that's independent of the top quark mass, so it doesn't matter how heavy it is. And the formula is 288 pi squared and Higgs squared over Bellman. So this is a roughly 5% branching ratio for a Higgs of mass 120 g. Now, if you can decay that way to gluons, you could also decay to photons. And so another set of diagrams that you can draw is you can have the Higgs decay to a top quark, and then the top quark annihilating the two photons. And then we can also put W. So W bosons in the loop. And so this is a little smaller. The alpha S gets replaced by an alpha. The formula, I won't write it out completely in detail. Higgs to gamma is equal to 0.27 times alpha B alpha squared divided by pi m Higgs cubed over m W squared. So for m Higgs equals 120 G, this would be roughly a 5% branching ratio. And this thing would be a rather small branching ratio, about 2 times 10 to the minus 3. Nevertheless, they're both important, as we'll see. OK, so that's what I wanted to tell you about the Higgs branching ratios. Of course, everything depends on the Higgs max, which we don't know. But when we find it, the standard model gives us a very definite prediction about how it should decay. So aside from the Higgs mass, there are no free particles. So if you look at the figures, figure 2, 3, and 4 basically show this pattern. So figure 2 is for a Higgs mass that's below the WW threshold. And then you see there's a very complicated pattern of decay modes. Bottom, charm, tau, gluons, way down at the bottom you see the decays to gamma-gamma, and also to gamma-z can be seen. You also see the WW and ZZ begin to come up. These are Ws that can't both be on mass shell, but nevertheless they're important for the reasons I discussed. Okay, if you now turn the page, you'll see the Higgs branching ratios just in the W and Z threshold region. Actually, interestingly, everything gets cannibalized by the W in the region between 160 and 180, where the Ws can be on shell, but the Zs can't. And then if you turn the page again, you'll see the region above the W threshold. So there, the Higgs decays are completely dominated by W and Z. As you know, off the light diagram, the Higgs becomes as wide a resonance as its mass. And then you also see that the top quark doesn't quite measure up, because the top quark doesn't have this factor of m Higgs squared over m W squared that comes from the longitudinal polarizations. OK, so that's what the Higgs should actually look like in an experiment. So now, how do you, so that's what, in some sense, what we should look for as a function of the mass window in which we might expect the Higgs to sit. So now, how do you make Higgs bosons so that we can actually go look for them? So the most effective search technique so far is to look in E plus E minus annihilation. So in E plus E minus annihilation, you have the following quite interesting process. E plus E minus annihilate. They produce an off-shell Z boson. And then that Z boson can radiate a Higgs boson and go on show. So the net process is E plus E minus Z Higgs. This vertex is the Higgs ZZ vertex. So we know exactly what that is in terms of the Z mass and the Higgs vector magnification. The process is kind of easy to look for, because what it looks like in the detector is that Z maybe came to two jets or two leptons on this side. And then whatever's on this side is the Higgs boson. So you can actually look for the Higgs boson independently of its decay mode. Although, of course, if you look for a particular decay mode, you probably have a more sensitive structure. So this was looked for at left up to energies, I think, 210 GeV in the center of mass. The results from LEP are shown on the next slide. So what this is the following experiment. You look not for this configuration, but for some very specific final state of the Higgs. So we're talking about Higgs is, we have to produce a Z. So if you subtract 90 from this, you come to of order 120 GeV, there's some phase space. So we're talking about Higgs's that are in the range of 100 to 110 GeV. What you look for is a Z, either dileptons or two jets on this side, or maybe neutrinos. And then on the other side, they look for the Higgs to BB bar decay, which is supposed to be the dominant decay in that mass region of the Higgs. And so then there are two jets on this side, and these jets also have detons. And then in that figure, it's where you make a rather loose B selection or a very stiff B selection. And what's plotted is the invariant mass of this two-jet system. And so if there is indeed a Higgs boson, that invariant mass should show a peak at the mass of the Higgs boson. Well, you can see that there is a peak in these distributions. But of course, that peak comes from the process E plus E minus goes to ZZ, because the Z can also decay. And then for the Higgs, you would expect a peak at higher mass. But let's just say the evidence for that is no more convincing than the evidence that CDMS has discovered dark matter. And so there we are. So the left puts a limit, and the limit says that the mass of the Higgs is greater than 114 GeV. Yes?
So if the Higgs just so happen to have the same mass as the Zen, then you were really unlikely, would we actually see it as just a higher peak?
Yeah, you'd see it as a higher peak, and because we know all these couplings extremely precisely, that's actually excluded. So people worried about that, but because of the precision to which we know all of these quantities, it's actually excluded by many signals. Yes?
Was there like a reason to think that the Higgs might be the same mass as the Zen?
No, there's no good reason. Yes?
On these plots, are the background things fit or Monte Carlo?
The background things are Monte Carlo, actually. The background things come, well, of course, there's the Z background. So you model this process, which is predicted in the standard model. And then there are various processes by which E plus E minus can produce four fermions. And it's E plus E minus to two photons that produce four fermions, or E plus E minus to QQ bar, which produces four fermions. So all these diagrams were actually computed and put into the Monte Carlo. A huge amount of work. Okay, and as you see, the background description is really pretty good. In fact, for experienced people, surprising. Okay, so the next place you could look is at the next higher energy accelerator, which is the Fermilab chemistry. And this study at the Tevatron is still going on. So let me tell you how you would search for the Higgs at the Tevatron. The Tevatron is a proton-antiproton collider, so you have quark. So there are two ways to do it. One is to look for the analog of the process we just discussed, that is QQ bar annihilation, into a W or into a Z. And then you look for the W and Z, and then recoiling against it, you look for Higgs and UV bar. And the other way to do it is to just look for generic Higgs production. But then you have to look for a very characteristic quantum state. So the one that seems to be most successful is that you can make the Higgs from gluon-gluon by the same vertex that allows the Higgs to decay to gluon. But then, as I say, you need a characteristic final state, so you can look for the decay to W plus W minus. Then this thing turns into a lepton and a neutrino. And so you're looking for events with two leptons, lots of missing energy, and nothing else. And so this, if you like, is what you would like to do in the low mass region of the Higgs, where the low mass being just above the lepton. And when the Higgs gets higher in mass, the W branching ratio turns on, and this becomes more effective. And then this is most effective right near the Higgs to WW threshold. So Higgs is about 160, 170. So this current status of this search, and I really mean current, this paper just came out about 2 months ago, is shown in the next figure. So what you see in the left is the left exclusion. In around 160 or 170, there's a region where the Higgs mass is excluded because this process is not observed. At lower masses, the exclusion is given by the black line. And the solid line that goes across, labeled SM, is the standard model prediction for the Higgs cross-section. So right now, they're excluding for Higgs just above the LEP limits, Higgs cross-sections that are roughly double the expected standard model value. And the hope is that, well, the hope I've heard expressed is that as they get more data, they can exclude the Higgs all the way down to the standard model value. Of course, I hope they don't exclude the Higgs. But we'll see what happens. OK.
So what's the expected line on
those? Oh, okay, so this is the luck of the draw, right? You get some events, and then, so you do a calculation, you predict a number of events. Then you also do the experiment, and you get some events. And so the expected is how many events you would have expected to get, just the average value. And then it's probably got a one sigma error bar. And then the actual is how many events you actually saw. So if the expected number of events is small and the number of events you actually saw is large, then you probably saw the thing. If the expected agrees with the actual, that means you haven't seen it yet and you're probably excluding it. Okay. Yes. And the standard model, the standard model is a cross-section level. And the expected is the cross-section that you can expect to exclude based on the amount of data you take. So as you take more data, the expected limit goes down. And eventually you can exclude the standard model value. But if you have not enough data, then you can only exclude values of the cross-section that are higher. Okay. Yes?
So the bump between like the two WP regions, is the bump there because we have lower sensitivity between those two mass regions?
That's right, because the bump is there because this is maximally effective at low mass. This is maximally effective near 160 GeV, okay. And the region in between falls to critics.
Okay, and so there's no reason to believe that the Higgs mass should fall between those pink.
No, although probably when Ben Allenuck is here, he'll try and persuade you that the Higgs mass is very close to 120. Okay, so now, as you all know, there is a new accelerator in business now, which is the LHC at CERN, the Large Hadron Collider, with proton-proton collisions, eventually, we hope, at an energy of 14 TeV. And also, we hope, with luminosities, which would correspond to 100 inverse femtobarns a year, that is, for a one femtobarn cross-section, 100 events per year. So at the LHC energies, there are two new strategies that come in. So the first new strategy is that we have available this process. But remember that I told you that the number of gluons in the proton increases very rapidly as we go to small values of x, the fraction of the proton momentum that the gluon has. So as I crank up the proton energy, more and more gluons, in fact, enormously more gluons, have enough energy to make the Higgs. And so now I can look for rarer modes in the final state. And so you can imagine looking for Ws. You can imagine looking for Zs. At the LHC, you should have enough rate if the Higgs is above the Z mass to even allow the Higgs to decay to leptons on both sides. And so if you saw four leptons and the pairs of leptons summed to the Higgs mass, that would really be very convincing evidence that it's there. And so there's actually a simulation of that on the next slide from the CMS experiment at the LHC. So you can see that with the right cuts, you can actually imagine seeing extremely beautiful narrow Higgs mass peaks. If the Higgs is above 180 GeV, actually, on the left-hand side, it's even a case where it decays to ZZ star. And one Z is on shell, and the other one is off shell. Now, if the Higgs is lighter, though, this mode turns off, and you have to look for other modes. So there, the mode of choice seems actually to be the rare decay, Higgs to gamma gamma. So you make the Higgs in glue-glue. The cross-section is about, let's say for a Higgs of 120 GeV, it's about 30 picobarns. So that's a hefty cross-section. Then the Higgs, so this here is 30 picobarns. This is a branching ratio of 2 times 10 to the minus 3, which is puny. Nevertheless, it's very characteristic because if you find you measure these photons very well, you add up their momentum vectors, there should be a peak at the position of the Higgs. This peak occurs on an enormous background of processes like QQ bar to gamma gamma, or various kinds of processes that make pi zeros, which then look like single gammas if you don't detect them extremely precisely. So one has to worry about all these things. So on the next slide, there shows a CMS simulation of this. I caution you in this slide that the red thing, which is the Higgs signal, is multiplied by a factor of 10 so you can see it. But nevertheless, that signal is expected to be significant, statistically distinguishable on the background, which is plotted. So roughly, enormous background, tiny blip like that. And if you measure very accurately this mass, you can distinguish the blip on the background. And that would be the discovery of the Higgs boson. And then gradually, as you get more and more statistics, this would become more obvious. There would be other ways you could see it to confirm it. It's actually not so unreasonable, but it's a hard experiment. Yes?
Can you say a couple of things about what bonds are and actually what you mean by discovery as opposed to just evidence or something? I don't think we've seen these units.
Oh, the unit of a bond. This is a very practical unit. One barn is equal to 10 fermi. So
squared is equal to 10 to the minus 24 centimeters. So this is the typical unit in which you express cross-section. So a Fermi is about the size of a proton. And then this is a square, which is 10 protons on the side. So the proton-proton total cross-section is at the LHC is about 100 millibars. So it's, yeah, roughly the size of a proton. Cross-sections for things like proton-proton to go to the top quark at the LHC are it's something like 900 picobars. So it's milli, micro, nano, pico. So this number here is 10 to the minus 10 of this. And then this number here is another factor of 30 small. But the unit I quoted to you is 1 year is supposed to be 100 events for a cross-section of one femtobarn, which is 1,000 events, 100,000 events for a cross-section of one picobarn. And so there are events there. It's just that there are billions times more of uninteresting events that you have to find these in the middle of. I could go on for hours, but I think I won't. Okay. So let's see. There's one more technique which is interesting at the LHC, which is that when you get to really high energy, you can also make W bosons in a way that the W bosons can then make Higgses. And an interesting process is what's called WW fusion, which looks like this. You have an up quark that turns into a down quark, making a W plus. You have from the other proton a down quark that turns into an up quark, making a W minus. And then those guys fuse to make the Higgs. Now you have some extra handles, because there's a very fast jet going forward, and there's a very fast jet going backwards. And then the central region is kind of empty, except for the Higgs decay products. So it's thought that, for example, you could see the Higgs to tau-tau decay in that environment. And on the next figure, there's a simulation of that from the CMS study. So the other thing you can make in this channel, there's a WWZ vertex. And the Z decays to tau tau. So in this figure, which is a simulation, you see the peak from the Z, and then above it, there's a subsidiary peak, which would be from the Higgs boson. So if you could actually get this data, it would be clear that you've done the experiment right, because the Z is in the right place. And then there would be an extra contribution from the Higgs that you would then discover. Okay. Now, that's, I guess, what I wanted to tell you about the Higgs boson. So people are going to now do these experiments in the next couple of years. And we'll see. Oh, sorry. There's one more figure here. If you then turn the page, there's a summary of all of these various ways of looking for the Higgs boson from the LHC. So basically, the curve is higher if you're more sensitive. And this is the number, I think, of sigma sensitivity with a 30 inverse femtobarn sample. So what this curve is supposed to persuade you of is that if we actually get several years of good running at the LHC at an energy of 14 TeV, that we're very likely to discover the Higgs if it's the standard model Higgs. For more or less any value of the mass which is currently allowed. So I think that's a correct statement, and it's certainly very promising as far as this business of the completion of the standard model. So now the question is, well, is this a good thing or a bad thing to complete the standard model? So what I've emphasized to you throughout this course is that the standard model really is a pretty tight package. We start from a few principles. The Young-Mills is the origin of all interactions.
We add to Young-Mills the gauge group, the representation content of fermions. We then get more or less everything that we know about particle physics. It's really incredible. The one piece, though, which is really unsatisfactory, is this theory of spontaneous symmetry gradient. Because what we do to get spontaneous symmetry breaking is we introduce this scalar field called the Higgs. We say the Higgs has a potential, which is minus mu squared phi squared plus lambda phi to the fourth. If you ask, where did this potential come from, the Standard Model has no answer to this question. It just says, write this down. So for me, I must say, this is extremely unsatisfactory. In all the big examples of symmetry breaking that we know in nature, magnetism, superconductivity, actually even the chiral symmetry breaking of the strong interactions that I told you about last week, there's a very definite physical mechanism that leads to the potential that gives you spontaneous symmetry breaking. So write it down doesn't seem to me to be an adequate solution. You not only have to write it down, but you have to write a minus sign here. So why is that a minus sign? Well, the theory gives you no answer to that question. In fact, the theory, it's even worse than that. Because if you compute the diagrams that give radiative corrections to this term, this one gives you plus lambda, and then it's actually ultraviolet, quadratically ultraviolet divergent. So whatever you got, there's actually an additive term, which is ultraviolet divergent. If you compute the correction from W's, you get another plus G squared times lambda squared. If you compute the correction from top quarks, this one's actually negative and ultraviolet divergent. So not only does the theory not give you any clear answer about what this parameter is, it doesn't even give you the sign. So unless you can somehow understand what's going on at very high scales, there's no understanding of even what the sign of this term should be, which is the crucial thing about whether the symmetry is broken or not. So it just seems to me that there's got to be something more up there, that the Higgs boson has to be a part of a larger structure that is going to somehow give you a physical understanding of where the symmetry breaking comes from. And I must say, for me, this is the number one question in particle physics. So I thought at the end of this lecture, maybe I should make you a list of what people consider to be the major unsolved problems in particle physics. And then based on what you've learned in these lectures, you guys can go off and work on them. So here they are. So I think in no particular order, the first one is the understanding of why do we have this SU3 cross SU2 cross U1 gauge group? Why do we have the particular representations that we do, the particular quantum numbers, and why three generations? So there are various answers to that question. If you did the problem set, you'll see that why the quantum numbers might be answered if we have a grand unification, where SU3, SU2, and U1 are all subgroups of some fundamental, big, simple Lie group, for example, SU5. On the other hand, that still doesn't answer this question. And there are other answers out there. In string theory, you have a picture where you have extra dimensions. There are things called D-brains that span those extra dimensions. And you get SU3, SU2, and U1 because you have a stack of three D-brains somewhere. And somewhere else, you have a stack of two D-brains. And somewhere else, there's one D-brain. So there are many ways of addressing these questions. And frankly, we don't know. OK, the second thing on this list is the unification, the inclusion of gravity. So you notice that I didn't mention gravity in these lectures.
But obviously, gravity is a fundamental interaction, which is an interaction that couples to all of the elementary particles that we've been talking about. How does gravity fit into some big structure that we'll build? String theory has a very interesting answer to that question, which you'll hear about. Other proposals have been made. We don't know. The next thing is that we haven't heard the end of the story of CP violation. So yesterday I told you that as far as elementary particle reactions are concerned, we have a theory that explains all observed CP-violating reactions. It's this Kobayashi-Maskawa theory that says that all CP violation in particle physics comes from the one allowed phase in the weak interaction charge current. However, this mechanism of CP violation doesn't explain the biggest macroscopic violation of CP violation of all, which is that we're made of protons and electrons. And out in the universe, we don't see anything but protons and electrons and just trace amounts of antiprotons and positrons. And so there's some asymmetry there. And what's the origin of it? So if you now think about inflationary cosmology, this problem becomes a lot worse. In inflationary cosmology, some small region of space blows up to huge size. And when it blows up, things that are conserved. So basically, it ends up with, in our universe, zero net baryon number and zero net lepton number. And then the universe has to evolve from there to a situation where there are net baryons over antibaryons and net leptons over antileptons. Such a process requires baryon number and lepton number non-conservation. But actually, oddly, the standard model gives you those through some, again, secret process that I haven't told you about. But it also requires CP violation, because you have to produce the baryons asymmetrically from the antibaryons. So it turns out, when you actually work through it, that this KM phase cannot do that. Roughly, the KM phase is totally ineffective when you go to high temperatures. In particular, even temperatures above the B quark mass. So there is a new source of CP violation out there that we haven't talked about, and nobody knows what it is. Some people think it has to do with neutrino mass. Some people think it has to do with the extra physics of the Higgs sector. Nobody knows. And then finally, there's this question of the identity of the major components of the universe, dark matter and dark energy. So you all learned in your cosmology course that the kind of particles that I've been talking about in this lecture are only 5% of the content of the universe, that roughly 20% is some new kind of matter which is not included in the standard model called dark matter. And the rest of it is this energy content of the vacuum called dark energy. Dark energy is a really hard problem. I personally think that we're not ready for the solution of the dark energy problem. Even to frame the questions, we're not quite there. But dark matter is a whole other situation. Dark matter is a kind of particle, very much like the particles in the standard model. There are concrete models of dark matter. For example, you add some interactions to the standard model. This then allows you to produce dark matter particles thermally early in the history of the universe. The universe expands. Particles are left behind. They're stable because of some new quantum number. And they just hang around. If they're neutral and weakly interacting, that's a perfect theory of dark matter. Oddly, these theories work best if the mass of the dark matter particle is just around 100 GeV. So not only can we make theories of dark matter, but actually there are really interesting theories of dark matter, where dark matter is literally just around the corner, where it's in a region that our accelerators either already rule out those theories, or where at the next stage in accelerators, hopefully at the LHC, will actually start producing dark matter particles. And then finally on this list is the origin of electroweak symmetry breaking.
So I gave you the argument here that there's some new, as yet undiscovered, force of nature which causes the Higgs boson to have an asymmetric potential. And we don't, there are theories of it, but frankly, we don't have a clue as to what it is. But again, the energy scale for this is of order V, which is of order 200 GeV. So again, this is in an energy region that we're now going to explore experimentally at the LHC. Well, these problems up here are pretty hard. And it's quite likely that we're not going to get direct experimental evidence for these anytime soon. But these two down here, it's a whole different story. We're turning on this big accelerator in Geneva. It's really going to give us a lot of information about this energy region. And there are these two very important problems in particle physics for which the information that we need is very likely to come up in these experiments. So I guess that this is really what I would say is the crucial issue for the next era of particle physics, the one that takes us from the current standard model to some new model that actually explains these two phenomena. And this, of course, is your era in particle physics. So good luck with it. So thank you very much.
On behalf of the school, I'd like to thank you very much for this really exciting series of lectures. And if you are a school teacher,
pride, yes. Thank you. For those of you who are going away for Christmas, you won't be able to access the wiki, and I still owe you two sets of lecture notes, this one and the bonus lecture on the top quark. I will put those on the wiki by the end of the day, but also I'm going to put up all these lecture notes on my own website at Slack. So that's publicly accessible from anywhere. So if you're traveling, you can at least get it that way. So,
so it's been suggested that we should, I should discuss a few things with you guys with regard to the conversation. Is this the right time, or is this fine?
Yeah.
Yeah. There might be somebody out in the lounge there. Okay, so I just wanted to actually, talk